Coming up next on 94.7 WPVC LP Charlottesville, it's Apropos of Something, co-hosted by Ellen Daniels and Nancy Lawrence. Apropos of Something welcomes experts, activists, and the marginalized from our community to discuss how the latest policies are affecting everyday people. Apropos of Something is brought to you by the Beckham team at Keller Williams. And now, here's Ellen.
Welcome, everyone. This is 94.7 WPVC Resistance Radio, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Welcome to Apropos of Something. We air every Saturday morning from 10 to 11, co-hosted by me, Ellen Daniels, in our Charlottesville studio, and Nancy Lawrence from our studio in New York City. We seek out the most interesting people we can find with a passion for social justice, political activism, and the arts, and we guarantee every show will be apropos of something. We are very grateful for the sponsorship of the Beckham team at Keller Williams Realty. We're going to do things a little differently today. We're here live during breaks and with our favorite original segments, but we're going to play one of our greatest hits. We have one of our fantastic, inspiring guests on cue. She is Christine Mahoney, co-founder of the Alight Fund, which works to empower refugee entrepreneurs. They help them grow small businesses in conflict or displacement zones. She's written the book Failure and Hope, Fighting for the Rights of the Forcibly Displaced. She is professor of public policy and politics at the Frank Batten School of Leadership and Public Policy. She also directs social entrepreneurship at the University of Virginia, which helps students there learn about social entrepreneurship through experiential classes, speakers, hackathons, global field experience, and internships. And we also will hear from writer Philip Jason, who's finishing up his second year of graduate school at the University of Virginia. He's the winner of the 2017 Henfield Prize for Fiction, one of the most prestigious individual prizes available to promising writers. But first, my partner in crime, Nancy, are you there?
I am here, the usual suspect. I am here collecting a misdemeanor for being so. No, I am aware, Ellen, we're doing our first, is it a very special episode of Apropos Something or a lost episode? Or
yeah, it's one of the very special ones that we've chosen, handpicked for our listeners.
Oh, it's an artisanal show.
We are in Charlottesville, so yes, of course, and you're in New York City, so you know all about artisanal.
Something you might find at the city market quality show.
Right. Wow.
Like that. If I can fake my way through a local map, a Google map, I will do so.
Yes. So I
thought. So did you write intros for us, my dear? Can you glow upon us some of our. No.
We should. I should write one for you, and you should write one
please,
for me.
That would be something. We should do that. Okay.
Let's do our next
live show. That'll be the assignment. I'm calling it.
Mine would be chock full of how amazing you are as a friend. Okay, are you embarrassed? I don't mean to embarrass you.
I am. Fortunately, I don't know if blush permeates through the air. If it does, everyone can hear it. The pink hue is blustery red.
So my vision for this part of the show, before we go to our interviews, and then you can tell me if you had the same vision or not, was just to talk a little bit about how we got started on the show. We were newbies to the whole thing. We still kind of are. And just like, I don't know, just chat a little bit about that.
Yeah, what's your, assuming you've got key A in, you know, inserted into disjunction panel Q already, what is an early memory of yours of our collaborating on the air with guests in tow?
Well, it's live radio, and there have been so many things that have gone wrong before the show that no one's known about. And
I think they're going on right now.
No, they're not. This is all very right. Just like crawling under the desk and trying to look at plugs and things, all kinds of crazy things. But I think our guests are really the highlight. Those are definitely my favorite moments. But also, maybe before that was the moment that Jeff Leonard, station owner, turned to me when I was doing just my regular morning shift, which is not this show at all, on a Friday morning at 6 a.m. And he turned to me and said, someone's not doing their Saturday show. Do you want a show? And I just couldn't believe it, because you and I have been having really what we thought were really great conversations on our own. And we kind of fantasized about having a show. And then there it was.
I know. Life doesn't usually work like that you are discussing something that wouldn't that be amazing if, and then you actually were presented with that opportunity, and he so kindly said, in short, I mean, essentially, go to it, you know.
Yeah.
Go.
And how long?
10 to 11 on Saturday, you know.
Right. And how long did it take for you to really believe it was real?
I definitely until that morning,
right.
Until you were calling or I was calling in, did
yes.
I expect, you know, circumstances to, the winds to change or whatever they say, and
yeah.
A mirage would, you know, it would have been. Yeah, no, I totally didn't. It was too good. It's that we are up to, I don't know what you count, I know we were discussing this, is this 36, is this 35
yeah.
and a half? But the fact that we have at least, we definitely have 35 shows, meaning 70 and more than that guests, is unbelievable to me.
It is.
You know, it's amazing.
You know, I realized that later in the show we were going to do like something favorite, and we do the palate cleanser, we do the news of note, but I'm going to do, it's going to be a real news of note, so maybe perhaps now, we were going to do, you can fill in the blank, but I think it was going to be our favorite apropos news of note guest or something.
It was talked about. It wasn't official,
oh, good.
As always.
Okay.
Always
good, because that, yeah, because that's not happening.
Regimented that way. Okay. Okay.
I think the show...
Are you bringing cake? No. Did you bake goods? No.
You know, soon we're just going to forget we're on the air, and that'll be a lot of trouble.
No, I'm keeping an eye on it. I see we got like a couple minutes before we bring Christine's... Or you do, I, of course, as usual, just sit here.
I'm going to try to go right on yeah. cue, and that we have like just a few seconds. So if you don't mind, I'm going to start it out.
You are?
Yeah.
Okay. You know, I feel bad. Before you do, I feel badly. I remembered now that after we chatted with Christine, she sent us an email saying that her mother listened in Philadelphia. Do you remember her mother was listening?
Yes.
And it occurred to me too late that we should have let Christine know that we are rebroadcasting her interview so that she could remind her mother to take a listen. Anyway, okay.
We can do that after the fact. I purposely...
You know what? You're right, Ellen.
I know. That's... I purposely didn't say anything because who knows how this was going to go, really, in reality.
Okay.
But
fair enough.
I'm ready to go. Okay. I'm going to start the interviews. Ready?
I dare you. Yeah.
All right, here we go. We do have an amazing, amazing show.
Yes.
Our first guest is Christine Mahoney. She is co-founder of the Alight Fund, empowering refugee entrepreneurs to grow small businesses in displacement-affected zones. Her book, now available in paperback, is Failure and Hope, Fighting for the Rights of the Forcibly Displaced. She is professor of public policy and politics at the Frank Batten School of Leadership and Public Policy, and also director of the social entrepreneurship at the University of Virginia. Welcome, Christine.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's our pleasure. So, as you say in your book, you've been all over the world on tuk-tuks, rickshaws, bicycles, buses. You've been studying displacement crises, including 7 conflict zones around the world. You've interviewed 170 humanitarian aid workers, government officials, and refugees. That's a lot. Can you give us a picture, a snapshot of the problem, how many refugees there are, and what are they facing?
Sure. So this last year, we actually made a new record globally where there's 65 million people displaced by violent conflict. So these are people essentially fleeing war zones. This is not people fleeing a hurricane. And the new normal is that these people will be displaced for years and often decades. So, for example, I was in Burmese refugee camps in Thailand where people have been displaced for over 20 years. Bhutanese refugee camps in Nepal, also over 20 years. And as many of the listeners know, the Syria crisis is now going into year 5 and 6, and so people have now been displaced for a half a decade. So that's the new normal. Unfortunately, our humanitarian kind of aid machine is about temporary. The idea was that you'd be displaced for a couple weeks, a couple months, and in that time you'd have a temporary tent and some temporary food, and then you'd go home. But the problem is, if you've been displaced for a decade or 2 decades, and all you have is a tent and some temporary food relief, that's not living, right? That's a life of limbo. And so that's why I was interested in writing this book, trying to understand, you know, where is there some success stories out there? Where have aid organizations been able to fight for these people's rights? Especially, another thing I want to point out is often people are not allowed to work and they're not allowed to move freely. So they're essentially worse off than the extremely poor because of national policies and international policy. They're not allowed to take care of themselves and their families. And so what I found in case after case is no success stories. Unfortunately, nowhere are really people allowed to work or move freely. Everywhere, people are stuck in limbo, and it's no way to live. And so that's why I wrote the book and am proposing a new solution, a different way forward, one that invests in small businesses and entrepreneurs and the host communities that welcome them, so that we can, you know, create a situation of economic growth to support those welcoming new refugees as well as the refugees themselves.
And I was just wondering, Christine, how long, you know, in your research did it take for you to arrive at this solution? Because I know you've been all over. Was it apparent right away just that this idea of just feeding them isn't going to solve this?
Actually, I wish I could say that was the case. No, it took me about 8 years. So I was doing the field work, and I guess I'm somewhat naturally idealistic or optimistic, and I kept thinking, I'm going to find a case where the aid workers and the UN have been successful in advocating for these people's right to work. And I kept going to more war zones and refugee camps and internal displacement camps and kept finding that to be not the case. And as an academic at a policy school, I really wanted to write a conclusion that actually put something forward, a useful proposal. And I was stuck for a year, to be honest. I was trying to come up with creative advocacy strategies. My background is advocacy. My first book was looking at advocacy and activism in the United States and the European Union. And for the life of me, I didn't really buy any of the ideas I came up with. So it took me a little longer than I planned, but at the same time, I was building the social entrepreneurship at the University of Virginia program and reading about really innovative microfinance strategies, really innovative social enterprise strategies and hybrid models. And it was really through that work for the university that I realized that we needed a new approach to the refugee crisis.
Do you think the Syrian crisis is sadly, you know, helping you in only this way, you know, draw more attention to these more permanent, the entrepreneurship solutions, is that it gets much more press than just the refugee, anyway, do you think it helps?
Interesting. Yes, I think, and it's, you know, for 7 years I was doing this field work, and in my mind it was a global refugee crisis, though no one was referring to it as that. In the middle of my work, there was 35 million people displaced, and that was a big problem, but it was really not getting any coverage at all. Actually, the first two substantive chapters in my book look at media coverage in the United States and the European Union over a decade. And what I found is the vast majority of forcibly displaced crises, so there's 65 of them burning worldwide, 60% of them receive no news coverage whatsoever. So sadly, the Syrian crisis did shine a light on it in a way that I think has been helpful. Because of the crisis getting so bad, many of your listeners may know, during the UN General Assembly last September, there was a big focus on the refugee problem. President Obama founded something called the Partnership for Refugees, which has been taken over by the Tent Foundation, which is funded by the entrepreneur that started Chobani, who really believes in supporting refugees. And so all of these different people are focusing on the need to do something different, the need to move toward long-term economic development, and the need to engage the private sector and investors and businesses, because the problem is so big, it can't be solved by government or the UN alone.
Well, being that 60%, you know, isn't probably still getting coverage, please explain the process of getting anyone in a room, investors, you know, how do you even start doing that part, which I know is integral. You need the money to get these people on their, you know, on their feet.
Well, thankfully, the founder of Chobani has made a major commitment, a few $100 million. George Soros has also shined light on this problem and has committed $500 million to invest in this space. So that's been very helpful. You have kind of two luminaries really saying that they're going to put their own capital up, and then that can be encouraging to others. With the Tent Partnership and the President Obama's Partnership for Refugees, that really encouraged, I think, over 70 different private sector companies like IKEA and Visa and MasterCard, to make commitments. And so that's gone a long way. And then there's been a lot of convening. So last September, there was a number of convenings. The Alight Fund, which I co-founded, co-convened a solution summit in London a few weeks ago with the Boston Consulting Group, who's also very passionate about this issue. And interestingly, you know, we don't need, because as you pointed out, there's a lot of media attention now. And since the crisis is so big in Europe, and that's having a really big impact on European countries, people are just coming to the table. We're not really needing to drag them to the table. And so we had major international financial institutions like the World Bank, major investors like the Soros Fund, and the World Food Program, who is, you know, trying to feed millions of people, and a number of NGOs coming to the table as well. So really people are realizing that something needs to be done. And then now we're in the phase of figuring out what are the nuts and bolts? How do we get the investment to the entrepreneurs on the ground? How do we grow and scale companies that are serving and employing refugees and host communities? And how do we kind of directly improve lives?
Can you talk more about those details, what your fund is seeking to do?
So the LA Fund specifically, we founded to do microfinance. And so we began, our plan was to begin in northern Iraq, in the Kurdish region of Iraq. As many of your listeners know, Mosul was recently liberated. ISIS is a challenge in northern Iraq. But Kurdistan is actually quite stable. It has a pretty progressive government that is very interested in economic development. And the Kurdish, so there's Kurdish refugees from Syria in the Kurdish region of Iraq, and they've been welcomed very warmly. They're allowed to work. They're allowed to legally work by the Iraqi constitution. And so our plan was to begin doing raising a microfinance fund to invest in refugee and host community entrepreneurs there. We've gone and done a number of field trips there, met with government officials. There's a lot of pros, as I just discussed, but there's a lot of challenges right now as well. The price of oil has gone down. The government doesn't have any money. There's challenges between the central bank and the Bank of Baghdad. So there's a number of things that is slowing that work right now. So the long-term goal is to raise funds to do microfinance for refugees. But in the meantime, we're looking at alternative ways that we can support that work. And so last month, we partnered with the Tent Foundation, USA for the UNHCR, and Kiva to raise additional funds for Kiva's World Refugee Fund. The idea there is to get microfinance banks that are working on the ground lending to local poor people to begin lending to refugees so we can start collecting data and show that refugees are a good bet. Refugees know their businesses. They've may have lost everything, but they didn't lose their knowledge of how to run a business and know their skill set, whether they're a mechanic or a baker. And we want to show that is a good bet, and we're helping fund that so we can collect better data so that we can grow more investment.
You know, I have a feeling your answer will be cut in between with a commercial, but I will start with asking you, that data that you show investors, how do you accumulate it?
Well, this first partnership with Kiva is, Kiva works with a number of microfinance institutions on the ground in refugee hosting countries, and so we'll be working with them. The most important data to collect is repayment rates. And then with some of the nonprofits, we can collect information on, you know, is this improving lives? Is this improving the economic stability of households?
This is 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. We're talking with Christine Mahoney, co-founder of the Alight Fund, empowering refugee entrepreneurs to grow small businesses. We're going to continue talking with her, but you can find the fund online at alightfund.com. That's one L. And on Twitter at Alight Fund. We will be back after this. Welcome back. This is 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. This is Apropos with myself, Ellen Daniels, and Nancy Lawrence in our New York studio. We're talking with Christine Mahoney, co-founder of the Alight Fund, empowering refugee entrepreneurs.
Well, I'm not sure, actually, but Christine, were you done describing how you convince or assure investors that, you know, their money is doing what it's supposed to do with this data?
Yes, I think so. Okay. I mean, we'll continue to collect more. Obviously, the more data, the more convincing.
Okay, fair enough. I was also curious, the countries you've been to, what are they? And are there stories, the refugee stories that you see there, are they similar? Or are they all different in ways that you're about to say, if I would end my question?
Sure. I did field work on the Somali border and the Somali refugee camps in Kenya, just over the border in Kenya. Ugandan internal displacement camps in northern Uganda during the Lord's Resistance Army fighting. Internal displacement camps in paramilitary controlled zones in Colombia related to the paramilitary and ELN and FARC fighting in Colombia. Bhutanese refugee camps in Nepal. Many people know of Bhutan as the happiest place on earth, but they also kicked out a lot of their citizens. And they've been stuck in refugee camps for 20 years. Most of those have been resettled. In 2007, the United States took the majority of them. Burma, many people know that there's a junta there that's very violent, that has cracked down on the Karen and the Karini, and they're in refugee camps in Thailand. I did field work in Kosovo refugee camps and Croatian IDP camps and Sri Lankan internal displacement camps. And I think that was most of them. So a lot of the stories are similar. We actually heard a public service announcement at the beginning of the show, and one of the refugees interviewed said, you know, I wasn't born a refugee. These are people that had businesses, they had careers, and their lives were interrupted by fighting that had nothing to do with them. So I spoke with a woman who was kicked out of Serbia, and she had been in a refugee camp since 1994. When I was there, it was the first country I did field work in. And she told me this heartbreaking story where her daughter was about to start college. You know, many of us have that experience. You know, you remember that you were supposed to go away to college your freshman year. And her life got horribly interrupted, and they got forced into a refugee camp. They got pushed across a river at Bayonet Point. And her parents have, you know, PTSD and are suffering from mental health issues. And this girl never got to live her life. She's just stuck taking care of her parents in a essentially dwindling and dying refugee camp, a crisis that has long been forgotten. So many of these cases, people have been displaced. You know, there was Burundian refugees displaced from Burundi into Tanzania in 1976, and they were still there in the early 2000s. So many of these people, with very little help and very little media attention, are stuck in limbo for a very long time.
And the statistics are really staggering. 33,972 people forced to flee their homes daily because of violent conflict around the world. There were 715,000 asylum-seeking applications to the European Union. And as you mentioned, 65 million people are displaced by violent conflict around the world. What is the international community doing, and what are the responsibilities that they have or they've agreed to?
Well, it's interesting. We have a UN declaration on the status of refugees, and many nations are signatories to that. And we agree to protect people that are essentially fleeing persecution. And so through the UN and the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, the bare level of support is covered. But every year, the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees has to ask for more money and for appeals to take care of all of these crises. And they're often not funded fully as they are needed. So just the basic food, medicine, shelter is hardly getting funded. And then there's 10 other categories that are also not getting funded. So the international response has been, you know, as I mentioned, very temporary and just essentially keeping people alive. The burden really falls on what we call countries of first asylum. So this is Jordan, Lebanon, northern Iraq, the countries that people flee to first. Right now, you know, Kenya from the South Sudan conflict that just has blown up again. And so that's what I'm arguing in my book, and many of the people I'm working with in collaboration are arguing. The international community and the private sector business community really needs to step up and start supporting these host countries, because they're doing a huge job. Their own citizens are already struggling. They're often emerging markets and countries that are poor themselves. And then they're taking on the burden of, you know, millions upon millions of forcibly displaced people.
And being that you are, or, you know, all these investors, all these countries are in so many different areas, it's obviously such a political environment, each case being different. How nimble do you have to be with the work you're doing with these people you are, you know, you choose to support? How does that work for you guys?
Sure. I described a little bit about the challenges in Iraq. So we were, you know, very much looking forward to working in northern Iraq and the Kurdish region. And because of the challenges of ISIS and of Mosul and of the, you know, global price of oil and a number of other conditions, that work needs to be delayed a bit. We also, you know, so we're looking right now, you know, does Jordan look like the best option? You know, who are our partners? Where are people willing to invest? Where is stable enough to invest? You know, there's opportunities to invest in microfinance in Somalia, but, you know, many people are very concerned about the security in Somalia. So it's really trying to figure out a balance of what does the investment opportunities look like, as well as what does the security situation look like, and what are investors' needs to feel kind of confident that they'll be able to invest in a productive way. So it is a bit dynamic. You know, we've only been doing this for about a year now, and we're trying to figure out the most effective way to do it.
How has the travel ban affected your work, your ability to get to these places, and how does it affect the refugees?
Well, thankfully, it hasn't affected us too much yet. At first, it appeared that it was. When Trump passed the Muslim ban at first, one of those countries was Iraq. And so the Iraqi parliament was going to retaliate with a ban against Americans, which would have immediately meant we couldn't even go and do our work. Other, you know, nonprofits that are just trying to keep people alive also would have a hard time doing their work. Thankfully, the Iraqi parliament took a more enlightened view than our administration has, and they didn't pass that policy. So people are still able to do their work. But of course, it's, you know, it creates a hostile kind of climate, I think, toward American policy. But that's one of the benefits too of what we're doing is I think we can bypass some of the bad policy coming out of the U.S. administration. Obviously, it looks like, you know, our refugee ban will continue. The Muslim ban is continuing. And our cap on how many refugees will take to resettle is going to probably be much lower during this administration than it has been for over a decade. However, we can still do something. We can still support the vast majority of the displaced in the countries that they are living in. And we can do it through the private sector and bypass government.
So as we wrap up in the next couple of minutes, what do you think people can do that are listening? What can listeners do?
Sure. I mean, thankfully, Charlottesville is a really welcoming place. And we have an International Rescue Committee office here that does really fantastic work welcoming the few refugees that we will be able to bring in this year. So supporting the IRC is a great way. Also, Charlottesville has just been designated a welcoming city. We're part of Welcoming America now. So in September, I think September 15 to the 24th, we're going to be having a welcoming week. And we have a new organization that I'm on the task force called Welcoming Greater Charlottesville. So that week is going to be a week of celebrating immigrant rights, refugee rights, and celebrating the diversity that new Americans essentially bring to our communities and how that makes our economy richer and it makes our culture richer and it makes our fiction maybe richer, which we're going to be talking about in a second. So I encourage people to kind of keep their eye out for those exciting events and come on out and support them.
How do you engage? I know because we barely addressed the fact that you're a teacher, you're a professor as well. So how does the work you're doing, how do you engage your students at the social entrepreneurship program you run?
Well, it's actually kind of interesting. The students are really interested and excited about this, but I've been trying to figure it out from a conflict of interest standpoint. I believe that we need to move towards social enterprise to solve this problem. But when you talk about a social enterprise and not a nonprofit, a lot of people are concerned about conflict of interest. So unfortunately, like I've had lots of students interested in like, I want to work for the Alight Fund. I'm like, I don't think I can hire you. So right now, I think it's mostly just been from a exciting and encouraging standpoint. I think they're glad to see a faculty member doing something and trying to have an impact on the world and not just writing about it. But from a conflict of interest standpoint, I cannot hire them or take them on as interns. So hopefully it'll just inspire them to do their own thing and start their own organization.
Thank you so much, Christine Mahoney, co-founder of the Alight Fund, empowering refugees worldwide towards self-reliance and dignity. Their website is alightfund.com. That's one L. And they can be found on Twitter at Alight Fund. Thank you so much, Christine.
Thanks for having me.
Yes.
Thanks.
And in a moment, we're going to be talking with Philip Jason. But before...
Nancy, are you there?
I am totally here still.
Wow. Cool. So we just had a really cool interview, a replay, and...
Alight Fund with one L. That was so smart of you, Ellen. Truly. I mean, we can't see, so you're always looking out for our guests. I love that. I'm sorry. You were saying.
This is why you're my friend, okay? Pointing out the silliest thing that I do and thinking it's amazing. Well,
it is amazing.
You're amazing. All right. So,
with two M's. No, okay. Right.
So my news of note is...
Yes.
Is remember how people were arrested at the inauguration of, you know, who, back in January... You may remember, well, if not, let me just tell you a little bit about it.
Yeah, people were arrested? Is that
Yeah, so there was some rumbling going on. It was planned protest at the inauguration, and they just had the first trial of six people that were causing some disturbance there, and they were all found not guilty, which is really, really good. They were just simply, there were journalists, there were medics, They got all arrested. They all got arrested, or a lot of them got arrested, facing multiple felonies. So this is really, really great in a blow to the BLOTUS regime, which just loves to clamp down on dissent of any kind, that they were found not guilty. And this was particularly watched by people in the know because it was a bellwether for free speech, because one of the six was an independent photojournalist who was just there to document the protests. So it's some really good news of note.
Yeah, that is really good, because I'm sure you are too, just so well aware that what doesn't get covered enough, or in my opinion, is Trump's defamation of the judicial system, not just dismantling the FBI, but as well just putting in place judges that are not qualified, in short. So, I mean, it's just comforting to know that he hasn't completely replaced everyone on their benches, you know. So I'm thrilled about that judgment. Not to steal that thunder, actually to support it. I actually saw yesterday on the crawl that once again, his latest travel ban, I believe travel ban 3, was also tossed out by another judicial panel. I'm sure this will go up to the Supreme Court, but that too was, just like your news, just heartening to know that, you know, there are still people left floating around doing their jobs. Mm-hmm. You know, and he, much to his dismay.
It seems like a race to the clock to me, you know, before he can replace judges with Mueller. What do you weigh in on that?
I'm still feeling like by the time, even whenever it is that Mueller makes passes in or lists an indictment or whatever the correct jargon is, or you know, whatever news decisions he makes, they will be dismissed, in short, by the Republicans. They won't blink. They won't take it up, or they will have already made sure that half of the country, which they're already doing, as I know you know, will decide that they're all corrupt, they're all, you know, working for Hillary, or, you know, to that effect, and it actually won't matter. That is, the rule of law will officially, you know, at the highest levels be no more. That is my fear.
Well, I'm going to be in the street if anything happens regarding a firing of any kind. There's a movement, you know, for people to go into the streets.
Yeah.
So, you know,
all on the take. I mean, you know, as awful, he is awful. He is awful, awful, awful. He's not doing it alone, though. That's, as you know, I mean, that's the problem.
They're
just so checked out.
Right. Like during Watergate, Congress was Democrats, and now it's not that. So that is one huge difference. It's a constitutional crisis, really. But let's hope it doesn't get to that point. And I think our next guest that we're gonna hear from is more of an uplifting sort of fellow. I think it was a favorite of mine. So
well, how I know every so well, not enough, I guess. I don't know who's keeping score, but it is nice. It is nice to have people on that I don't know that remind us that, you know, just fun life goes on, you know, even though there are so many working to make sure life goes on for all of us, that we get these guests on that are just, you know, just nice to talk to, quite frankly. And Phil was definitely one of them.
Yeah. So let's play the interview.
Okay.
All right. To welcome our next guest. He is writer Philip Jason, second-year graduate student at the University of Virginia and winner of the 2017 Henfield Prize for Fiction, one of the most prestigious individual prizes available to promising writers. Welcome, Phil.
Hello.
Hi.
Thanks for having me.
Hey.
Yeah,
you're very welcome. So, since you're a writer, tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got into writing. If you could make it into a story, this is cheesy, I know, but tell us a little bit about your path to finding the career that you hopefully love.
It's been a long time. Like, you know, in fact, so it begins, I'm in college, and I think I started writing poetry because I was sad about losing a girl. Like that's the true beginning. I was writing these, like, I remember writing a poem that was called like Dead Roses Red, and it was like not a beat, not the smallest part, still beats within my too shattered heart. I mean, like this was like some of the first writing that I did.
It's good to get that stuff out, and then the other stuff can follow.
And then I took a history of science fiction class when I was like a sophomore. And it's weird. It's like they made us do a lot of reading, like really a lot of reading. I think we read like 30 books in the semester, which is even I think at a collegiate level is a significant amount of reading. And I don't know, something just happened while I was doing all the reading where I was just kind of like, oh, I kind of want to do this. So that led to a phone call to my parents being like, hey, this summer I don't want to work. and this didn't go over well with my mom, not even a little bit. I mean, at the time I was enrolled in business school at the University of Pennsylvania. So, I mean, we were expected
to be. That's another way to get chicks too. I can't believe this didn't work out better for you right at the get go. Anyway,
yeah.
Sorry,
so, you know, so we were supposed to like get like summer jobs on Wall Street and whatever. And I was like, nah, I'm going to do writing for a summer. And, I graduated and I guess I kind of just, like, I don't know, something just, I had half finished a novel and then I went on to do other things. I ended up becoming a house music producer or composer, however you want to look at it. Like, I was making house music that people were putting out on like vinyl records back in the early 2000s, and that came to an end, and I started writing again a little bit, and yada yada. Like, I went through this whole phase of like I reached a point where I was like, writing is silly. Like, there's just this is a waste of my time on this planet. I don't know what was coming through my head, and so I just shelved it as an idea entirely. And then again, I guess I was like, you know, a couple years after that, I just woke up one day and I was like, I want to do this. And it was the first time that like I really wanted to be a writer. Like, I just was like, I'm going to do this. I'm going to set out to do this. And that was about 7 years ago. And since then I've just kind of been working at it. You know, it's a slow grind,
So Philip Jason, we're talking to him. We'll continue talking to him after this break. He is a second-year grad student at UVA, winner of the prestigious Henfield Prize for Fiction in 2017. We'll be right back. Hey, Nancy, are you there?
I am there.
You know, did I not let you have a chance to do your news of note?
Ellen?
What?
I don't know. I'm not saying.
All right, good. All right, so we're going to continue the interview here.
All I know is the Elect Fund has one L. I'm sticking with it.
All right, let's continue with this fantastic times. All right.
Okay.
This is 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. You're listening to Apropos of Something, airing every Saturday from 10 to 11. I'm here with Nancy in New York City and Philip Jason, writer and winner of the Henfield Prize for Fiction.
So you were speaking of this slow grind, Phil, and I was wondering, you must have submitted work to journals and magazines, and what I'm asking is, how much rejection did you hear, and could you give us some details from your It's Never Going to Happen for You, Sir file? Knowing that it eventually did is the only reason that I'm asking.
Well, first of all, you were talking in, like, the past tense, as if the rejection had stopped.
Yeah.
I don't think it ever does, you know, until you really reach a certain strange echelon where, like, suddenly people stop saying no to you. But there's a lot of rejection. You send out pieces at first, and there's a learning process where you start to understand what's actually happening. Because at first you get these letters back saying, no, this is no good, and you're thinking, oh man, you know, this is all on me. Like, I'm not a good writer. And I guess over time, like, you learn things. You start to figure out that, first of all, like, these magazines are, you know, these days are receiving thousands of submissions. So it's not that your pieces are necessarily getting a great deal of attention. You know, if you were a reader at a magazine, you might have to read like 100 stories in a week, and that's exhausting. So you start taking it a little less personally. I mean, the big moment is really that first acceptance. And for me, the first acceptance was really weird. because first of all, I didn't even know it had happened. So there's like this online service called Submittable that basically all these magazines use now, where you submit your story through them and they set, like, you know, they use that to respond to you. So if they accept, they click a little button and you're supposed to get an email. So, you know, I was looking at the site and I just was, I guess, bored one day. I was playing around and you can like click on this one link that like just shows you all the stories that have been accepted. And I don't even know why I clicked on it on like my little page. And suddenly there was a story there and I was like, this is weird. I didn't get any sort of email, and then I looked through my spam folder, and sure enough, there was an email from like 2 weeks earlier that this magazine wanted this story. So I got in touch with them, and they were like, yes, you know, I was terrified that I was too late. Like, I didn't know how slow things really were. Like, I was like, oh my God, they think I don't want to be published. Now, flash forward 6 months. This story doesn't have the happiest ending. So I wait 6 months to hear from them again, and then I get an email from the editor being like, oh, hey, Phil, so here's the deal. We want to cut 3,500 words from your 4,000-word story and just publish it like this. And I wrote back. I was like, then that's not my story anymore. And then she wrote back, how dare you, pretty much. Like, you know, I have been published in the Paris Review and all of these things. How dare you question my editorial, you know, wisdom. So I was really bummed that my first acceptance turned out to be not an acceptance. But then, like a month later, I received another acceptance, and that story was eventually published in like the. In fact, it's the review that they do in the program at NYU. It's called Washington Square Review. So they published a story of mine, and like once you get that, just that thing that says, "Hey, you can do it." It gets easier. Like you suddenly your eyes open a little bit to what's really going on. You realize that all these rejections aren't necessarily personal. And then it's still like, you know, the thing is, it's still a very slow grind. Like it's still.
And speaking of success, tell us about the Henfield Prize.
Oh, the Henfield. So it's a prize they give out.
Is it too much of a burden to talk about?
I know.
So much. Like, everyone is always like, people come up to me on the street these days, and they're like, you look like a Henfield winner.
Well, I've mentioned it 50,000 times, so I gotta ask
you. So it's you know, like you come into the UVA program, and you know that this is a prize that they give out. And like, we don't, like, you know, the people in the program, we don't sit around talking about it all year, but it's a thing because, I mean, it's a significant cash prize. It's a $10,000 prize. And as a writer, like as a writer at almost any stage in your career, like most of these magazines, they publish your stories for free. Like they don't give you any money. And even the ones that do pay, you're talking about like, if you got $500 for a story, that's big. Like, so, you know, $10,000 for anything in the writing world is it's a significant sort of thing. So, you know, it's in your mind. You're like, oh, it would be nice to win the Henfield. And, you know, so I submitted my story. I didn't think I was going to win. Like there are other students in the program who were producing fiction that, I just loved. And I was just like, oh, this guy, you know, I was like, maybe I'll come in second. This would be nice. Like, I'm definitely not going to get first. I'll take second or third, like, you know, and then maybe have a shot at it next year. And so I submitted and I really wasn't thinking much of it. And then the school year had just ended and I had to go back to New York. You know, I just was coming back to New York for a few weeks, cause that's where I'm from originally. I was going to visit my parents and whatever. And the ride back to New York was horrific. Like, you know, it's supposed to take about 7 hours. It took 9 hours because there was an enormous amount of traffic from Staten Island, you know, all the way to like the LIE, which I know both Ellen and Nancy are familiar with these terms. People in Charlottesville are like, what's the LIE? The lie? Yes, it's a lie to think you're going to move at all on that highway. It is not an expressway. It is, you know, people just park their cars there.
It's the Long Island Expressway.
Yeah, it's the Long Island Expressway. I was in a terrible mood. We went to dinner. Like, I got home. We went to dinner, like, with my parents. And we're coming back from the dinner, and I'm driving. Because I think both my mom and it was Cinco de Mayo, so that's like my mom's favorite day of the year. She gets her margaritas on, and so like my parents had margaritas. So I'm driving, and like I shouldn't have been checking my email. I realize I should, you know, but like I check and I see that like there's an email announcing the winner, and so like I open it and I'm like, let's see who won, you know, like obviously not me. And I'm looking and I'm reading, and it just says like, you know, the name of my story, which is Heart Safe, is Heart Safe Phil Jason winner. And I was like, and like, there's, you know, it's small text. I'm like, I'm misreading this. Like, I'm definitely like, you know, and my mom starts screaming. She's like, Phil, pay attention to the road. And I was like, be quiet, mom. This is big. Like, and so like, I had to hand the phone to the back seat where somebody else was able to actually look at it and be like, oh my God, you did win. And it was definitely, I forgot about all the traffic. I forgot about the traffic that I had been sitting in all day. It was a really nice end to a grueling day. And it was surreal. Like, you know, for a few days afterwards, you're just sort of like, nah, this didn't really happen. You know?
And the way they did it, it's like they just CC'd you on your check. You know, it's amazing. I just so underplayed, like Fight Club or something.
Yeah, I was like, you know, I was like, oh, I hope there's a big check. I hope there's like, you know, there's a big Ed McMahon style Publishers Clearing House check in this for me. And no, like it was just, you know, like it's the honor of winning the prize is really more important, you know, than the money itself. I mean, so there was no like ceremony or anything, but I thought that was kind of funny that I just get an email. They're like, you know, please pay Phil his money. And that was it.
Phil, you're like,
you know, where's my big check?
What, I know you don't know much about the prize, but for people listening, can you at least please tell us what, like, the circumstance of it, how it gets, how you won it?
So it used to be a prize that, like, I think that this foundation called the McCrindle Foundation would give out to students, and like they would do it directly to like the best writing coming out of MFA programs in the United States. And then a couple years ago, they just endowed like five of the top MFA programs in the country to give this prize to one of their students. So, I mean, the first qualification for the prize is you have to get into the program at one of these schools, you know, and these are like UVA is one of the top schools, and it's like the admission rates are really low. It's something like, you know, like one in 150 people get in. And then once you're in the program towards the end of the year, you are allowed to submit a piece of unpublished writing. You submit it anonymously, like they know you submit like a cover sheet to the administrative Barbara, like, who's wonderful. Barbara, like, does a lot of the administrative work. Yes. kind of wish she was listening. I love Barbara. So she knows who everybody, she's the only one who actually knows who all the stories belong to. And then they give the stories to, a judge, like some, we don't know who the judge is at the time. Like, it's an anonymous thing, but they usually get a sort of well-respected writer to judge it. And then the judge picks a story, sends it back. Barbara figures out whose story is whose, and then they announce it.
What did you do? A well-respected writer. Get out of here. Can you put yourself down a little bit more?
No. I mean, they pick a well-respected writer to judge the contest.
I know.
So what do you do with that kind of money? I mean, as a writer, does that allow you to chill out a little bit and write, or do you just save it? Or
I mean, it depends. Like, I have a plan for a work that I want to do that would involve traveling. And so that might be something that I could use that for, like to do a little trip.
Where do you want to go?
Everywhere. I mean, like it's a project that involves like really traveling the world. So, you know, that's not free. Yeah. You know, no matter how much you backpack, like it's still.
What made you, well, without, anyway, what made you choose the piece that you did for this contest?
Oh.
Heart Safe.
Just sort
of personal.
Just,
I'm sorry.
No.
It sounds personal.
You know, this is a piece that, like, as a writer, as any kind of artist, I think, you know, I think people would assume that you write things and you're going to love and everything you write, and that's not how it is. Like, you know, I've written pieces that I just simply didn't care that much for. And some of those pieces have been some of my best successes. Like, you know, so it's kind of a weird thing. But this was a piece that, like, I loved because it, you know, when I was writing it, I just kind of, like, put aside all the rules. I put aside, like, I was just like, I'm just going to write whatever I feel like writing in the moment. The piece is kind of bizarre in that sort of way. And so I just loved it. Like, I loved what I had done in that particular piece. And
what was the piece about?
So it's about a...
again.
No. Sorry. Like,
No.
It's about... So there's a guy, and whenever his parents... Like, well, whenever his parents come to visit him, he takes his heart, and he puts it in a vault to keep it safe. And he forgets the combination. And so he needs to hire a bunch of, like, people to help him break into his own vault to get his heart back.
Wow. So, I like that.
I'm sure my parents are listening or trying to right now. Hi, Mom. Hi, Dad.
Trying. Yeah.
That's why you're having trouble describing this piece. All right.
Yeah, no wonder.
I didn't think about the listening audience.
It's okay. Read it. Yeah.
Do you describe your work as a style? Do you see it as a genre, or is it totally the opposite?
It's really,
think of the work.
It's really difficult for me to, like, it actually makes it harder for me as a writer that I can't specifically put it in a genre. I mean, the genre, like, it's a tradition, like, you know, it has a lot of magical elements. Like, you know, it's sort of weird. I bend the rules of reality. Like, my view on it is that I don't distinguish between, like, what is dream and what is, you know, what we consider waking life. And so, like, the two can kind of merge, and you can have weird things happening, like people taking their hearts out, you know, which you would see in a dream and maybe think was weird, but not think too much of it. But to think of it as, like, actually happening, like, I write those things as if they're really happening. It's,
thank you so much for being here, Phil. Yeah.
Thank you for having me again.
Yeah. UVA winner of the Henfield Prize for Fiction and a very interesting person, apparently. So thanks for being here. Also,
but don't tell his parents, Ellen.
I won't. And also, thanks to Christine Mahoney, co-founder of the Alight Fund. They're at alightfund.com, empowering refugees. Hey, Nancy.
Yes, Ellen. Look what we did.
Good times.
We talked to people, and they answered our questions. Always amazing to me. Still is.
You
Even though
so
I know it's
funny.
Happening, it's still amazing to me. Anyway.
You're hilarious.
No. Well, all right, fine.
This is the Palate Cleanser. That is fantastic music, isn't it?
It is exceptional music, Ellen.
I know you don't like
compliments. I get it, but it is exceptional music.
So my Palate Cleanser goes like this. In Poland, they've installed a blue bike lane that glows in the dark. If you see photos of it, it's really dazzling, but it's very easy on the eye, and it's a blue luminescent strip. It's made with phosphors, like the kind of thing that you have that glow sticks are made of, and it's this really magnificent deep blue. It produces light for more than 10 hours at a stretch and then recharges with the sun. And they chose blue to match the landscape of the town, which it's situated next to a blue lake. And this town is called Lidzbark. This is the best part of this, is that I get to pronounce. Lidzbark Warmiński is the town in Poland. And I think it's fantastic.
That is amazing. Good for them. That is so cool.
Yeah,
I miss news like this. Thank you. That is so cool. How did you... Don't reveal your sources. I don't mean for you to reveal your sources.
No. I won't. But I...
Okay.
There you go. What is your palate cleanser, Nancy?
Well, mine is not as cool. I guess that's the worst way to tell it. But anyway, it's related to what we're talking about most of this day, which is in 1920, a man named Dr. Frank Conrad, a ham operator in Pittsburgh, much more local than Poland. Anyway, he was playing records over the airwaves for his friends. And he was approached by Westinghouse, a leading radio manufacturer looking to sell more radios at the time. They asked him to set up a regularly transmitting station. And on November 2nd, 1920, his station, KDKA, in Pittsburgh made the nation's first commercial broadcast, and they chose that date because it was Election Day. It was so that the people could hear the results of the Harding-Cox presidential race before they read it in the newspaper. And so there you have it, you know, the radio essentially as an essential device for America started. And 4 years later, there were like 600 commercial stations across the country. And obviously other things happened after that as well.
I do love that. I mean, it's all about what at least I'm so passionate about. And you're maybe a little passionate about the radio, I hope. That is really cool. And the funny thing, it seems like, well, the funny thing is that I actually was looking into doing ham radio and just trying to decide if that was something that relates to what we do at all. So that's kind of cool.
You mean you at some point were trying to be a ham radio operator on your personal free time, et cetera?
Yeah, it came across my path, and I just the fact that there are ham radio people out there in Charlottesville doing that, and I just wondered if that was something that I'd be interested in. You know, one more thing to multitask.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
One more cord coming out of the back of some hub of yours where everything else is plugged in. That's all you need.
You know what? I'd like people if they're out there to let us know that they're listening, because with radio you have no idea like who's out there except for my mom. She listens all the time, which I really appreciate. But we're at AOS Radio on Twitter. Not a lot of people.
Yes, they do need to express themselves there. I wish they would. We would love to hear what is on your mind and what. Yeah, how you feel, let alone how you feel the shows are, but also what's on your mind.
What's on your mind? And contact, just friend us on Facebook, friend me. I could speak for myself. Just let us know you're there.
People. Yeah.
All right. So in January, come January, we're going to have amazing, even more amazing shows. We have to sign off now. So remember, no one has to do everything, but everyone has to do something. And Nance, it's been a pleasure.
Don't tell Trump that. He's doing way too much. Everyone but him.
Yeah. It's been a real pleasure to host with you today.
I totally agree, Ellen.
All right. Bye, Nance.
Bye.